find it, Halem know.
We believe the next clue is in the High Summit.
Only the chosen devout may enter the temple.
You just have to complete the journey of the Mother Compeer.
I'm the queen of endurance.
Having a spiritual awakening.
Sounds kind of wonderful.
There's no shortcuts here.
She doesn't need to die.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, going for a jog.
And we're here this week to talk about the latest episode, episode 6 of Discovery Season 5, the final season, Whistle Speak.
Yeah, Cam. So I think, I've got a bit of a fun story related to this. So I get this notice on my Apple TV Plus subscription, you know, it hits the notification on my phone, and it says that new episode of Discovery is ready to watch. And I'm like, okay, I mean, today's Wednesday, usually it doesn't come on until Thursdays, but okay. So later that evening, I go and I push, play to, continue watching the show, and they have the previously on Star Trek Discovery, and I'm watching this, and suddenly there are scenes popping up that I've never seen before in Star Trek Discovery on the previously, and I'm like, what is going on? And I was really confused, so I had to like push pause and then go backwards on the Paramount Plus app, and I thought what happened, episode 7 is called, I think, Iraga, and I thought what happened is you screwed up the name of the episode again this season when you're telling our listeners, what's coming up next. Because before you had said Mirrors and it was something else. And I thought you messed up the name again. And so I was about to mock you mercilessly. But what happened, something that's much more worthy of mockery, is that, the brain trust at Paramount Plus dropped episode 7 in Canada. Just Canada, before ever dropping episode 6. And so thankfully, all I did is I watched the previously on. I did not watch episode 7. I did not even have access to episode 6 anyways.
Yeah.
So I'm coming at you, folks. You may have heard some of the Canadians out there may have watched episode 7 in advance. I have not. But I will say that the previously on Star Trek Discovery kind of spoiled a lot of whistle speak for me as I went through.
And there's a lot to spoil.
Oh, I mean, gosh, golly, Cam. Yeah. So I don't know. It was just I just had to roll my eyes so hard at the joke that is Paramount right now, especially since the CEO has just recently resigned from the company as they're trying to conclude or try to get forward with some sort of acquisition deal in which they would be acquired by another company. And now they're being run by a committee of executives rather than a single CEO. Paramount is just a disaster right now.
Right. So when this happened and you discovered that, episode 7 had dropped, did you go online and see other people talking about the same thing at all?
I immediately went to Reddit. Uh-huh. And then I popped into Reddit, and I think there was one thread at that time in which somebody, it just said my synopsis of episode 7, and I clicked on that, and then I realized, the guy was literally trying to summarize the entire episode. So I just went past that, and I wrote my own comment, and I said I got spoiled watching the previously on, but that was it. But so there was a little bit of chatter on the Reddits,
but not as much as you would think with a hot show like Star Trek Discovery on the air, right?
Cam, I was literally the first one to comment on this thread, and I think the guy had posted it 3-4 hours earlier.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Just not much interest in an episode leaking a week in advance.
You know what would be interesting? And I guess if I was not lazy, I could figure this sort of thing out. But do you remember when Star Trek Discovery first started, they were showing it on primetime television?
Yeah. In Canada. Yeah.
Yeah, in Canada. And it was doing actually quite well in the ratings. It was making the top I don't know, 10 or 20 or something of Canada. I'd be curious to know, like, how the Canadian viewership of Discovery is held up over that time.
That's a very, very, very good question. Yeah, maybe we should research that.
Because it's not airing on TV now, is it?
Well, that's what I'm unclear about.
Yeah.
It might still be? I'm confused because, okay, so Bell owned the rights.
Yeah.
And so Bell was broadcasting it on the Canadian Sci-Fi Channel, as well as then maybe a day later, it would run it on the Crave TV app.
Yeah.
And so you and I ended up just watching it on Crave for, I think, actually, season one, I think you and I were watching it on television as it aired. Like, you would come over to my place.
Two, I think, as well.
Yeah. And then I think from season three onwards, then I think what happened is there's a pandemic.
Was there? I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. So then from season three onwards, you and I were just watching it over the app, and I just totally lost track. Like, I got rid of my cable subscription a long time ago, so I don't know.
Yeah. Huh. Well, maybe we'll dig into that one for next week and reveal the top secret Canadian stats for Star Trek Discovery on primetime television.
I know our listeners are on the edges of their seats right now.
Yeah. Well, speaking of being on the edge of our seats,
yeah,
let's get to Whistle Speak. Now, Tyler, is this still the fun Indiana Jones season that they promised?
Yeah, remember that great Indiana Jones sequence in which he went for a really long run and got dehydrated? You know, man, that was fun. Oh, Indy, you rapscallion, you.
I just remember, like, so much of the PR for the show before it launched in season five was like, we have brought fun to Star Trek Discovery. And, like, you and I definitely noticed maybe an uptick in sort of a lighter kind of tone in the first few episodes. But, like, going off of this episode and last week's episode, I feel like we're mostly just watching typical Star Trek Discovery.
That's what it feels like now. Yeah. Well, why don't we dive into the episode, though?
Yeah.
It kicks off with, I don't know, them saying the word clue 100 times in engineering.
Yeah.
They somehow make this giant leap in logic about connections to cultures that are big into water based on Denobulan trade routes from 800 years ago.
Uh-huh. It's like, and?
Okay. Sure. It's like, and the fact is, they make these giant leaps in logic, and guess what, Cam? Burnham has to be right. She always has to be right here.
This scene actually kind of annoyed me. I kind of like the flashing green, blue, and red like visuals they had. Like, there was some good cinematography going on here, but like, everything that happened in this opening of them figuring out that planet could have been just explained in voiceover. Like, we're tracking the next clue to this planet because we've realized blah, 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 blah. Moving on. Like, people, have some pace. Like, these episodes don't need to be 58 minutes. There's ways to cut around this. Like, this is the sort of information that, you know, Jean-Luc Picard would have given in voiceover at the start of an episode.
A captain's log.
But yeah.
The deal is, like, it's very clear that they're trying to cut the budget for Star Trek Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
One big way you could do it is by, you know, making these episodes 15 minutes shorter.
Yeah. And, like, anything like this where we're going to spend, like, 5 minutes of characters running around trying to determine what planet it could be on, which, ultimately, it doesn't matter. All we need to know is, give us a planet name. There we go. We don't need, like, minutes on minutes of characters trying to figure out what it is.
I was about to correct you when you said 5 minutes of characters running around. And I was going to be like, oh, no, Cam. More like 40 minutes of characters running around.
Oh, that's the rest of the episode. I'm just talking about them, trying to figure out the mystery. Oh, once we get to that planet, there's plenty of running around.
Okay, so we jump over to another scene with Kovich in, what do they call it? The Infinity Room or something like that?
The Matrix, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. He's just a complete cipher, but look, he has authentic legal pad. So I'm like, okay, cool. They figure out some names of scientists, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Like, this, Cam, does this scene seem necessary as well?
No. I mean, it's, what did they tell us in this?
I don't know. Like, I'm taking notes here, and it's like, as you say, Cam, all of this could have been in a captain's log.
All they really told us in that scene that I have noted is that basically each of these clues were developed by a different scientist in a different field so that the clues will relate to their field of expertise. But again,
sure,
as you just said, that could be voiceover.
Yeah. Again, it's also a giant leap in logic.
It is. And like, I'd love to know David Cronenberg's thoughts on his material in his episodes, because it's like he's not even playing a character. He just plays this cipher who pops in the into the Matrix and gives weird exposition and like basically like dangles mysteries over us.
I think he's happy to cash checks, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. There's just nothing to this character, like keeping him just like kind of a mystery.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, he looked cool in the first couple episodes of season three that he appeared on. I was like, okay, what's his backstory? Oh, they don't even know. You know, we don't even know what his job is with regards to Starfleet or the Federation. Like, he doesn't wear a Starfleet uniform.
No.
But I think he has like a comm badge. So, like, I don't get it.
He's just like top secret guy. But the thing is, we have four episodes left in this series. And I think like the likelihood of them delving into the mysteries of Kovich before the end of the show is very unlikely. And so like, is that just going to be the end of this show? Is just like, well, there was that character who was in a white room for some reason.
Cam, the last shot of Discovery, it's going to be the same shot as Thriller, where Kovich looks into the camera and his eyes turn into like wolf eyes for a split second. And then that, you know, that'll go down as one of the all-time, like, up there with The Sopranos in terms of one of those series finales you always talk about.
That, or it shows him walking, and then we zoom way, 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 way out, and suddenly Rage Against the Machine kicks in, and he goes flying past the camera.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. Okay. Yeah, the all of Discovery seasons 3 through 5 has just been in The Matrix. That, you know, that would actually explain a lot. I'd be okay with that, honestly.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. A simulation, yes.
Okay, so we jump over to one Dr. Culber, who's still having to figure things out after that Jantara ceremony. There, his mom speaking Spanish, you know, and I, at first I was like, is this necessary? But remember Discovery? Like, they were really into the Klingons speaking Klingon to each other in season one.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of wrap my head around. I'm sure there's some internet trolls saying like, why aren't they speaking English? And I was like, whatever, guys, get over it.
Yeah.
Who cares? I think the real issue here is kind of the storyline in which they're pursuing with Culber, you know, and like they want to, it's interesting in like the themes that he's dealing with in his like B story here, and the themes of the A story are kind of running in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you've got the A story aliens dealing with like, you know, they're very religious. They have a belief in God. And I think what Culber is trying to wrap his head around is dealing with uncertainty as they pursue those that created life as we know it in this, or humanoid life anyways, as we know it in this particular galaxy. So I wish I could say, I wonder where this is going, but the thing is, I find Culber's storyline more frustrating than anything else so far this season.
Yeah, I mean, I just, where does it go? Like, what is the resolution to any of this? And yeah, I mean, there's the part where he's talking, and I think it was his grandmother, actually,
okay.
Not his mother. Yeah. But like, he asks her for advice later in the episode, and she can't answer because she's the one that, you know, said he should pursue science. I'm like, okay, like, honestly, we have books saying just enjoy this experience. And I'm like, you know what? That's a great wrap up. Let's move on from this. Let's just enjoy it, Culber. And I'm good.
Yeah. Well, she's saying like, you're a man of science. And
yeah.
So this is where I'm getting a little, this is why I'm finding it just a little problematic, in that I wonder if where this story is going with this character and what they're trying to tell audiences is, yes, you know, like, you can be a man of science, but that doesn't mean God or a creator. That doesn't mean they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help view this storyline this season without the prism of knowing that the star of the show and the producer is a devoutly religious woman,
mm-hmm,
in Sneakwa Martin Green. You know, she's not like a person who goes to church on like Easter and Christmas. You know, she's a very, very religious person. And so I just wonder how much influence she has in this storyline that's going on, in which you have kind of, you know, Gene Roddenberry is very much a humanist, in which all of the great creations that we've seen, you know, the pyramids, what have you, it's not through the creation of gods or the influence or inspiration that gods may have imbued upon man, but it's man's own ingenuity. And I just wonder if this, who knows where this storyline goes to? Who knows if one person's interpretation of this storyline is completely different than mine? But this is kind of what's influencing my interpretation of the storyline so far this season.
Yeah, I remember there's the episode, I think it's Who Mourns for Adonai, where there's like a Son of God reference, and that was like a studio insistence. But yes, like that is not something Gene Roddenberry was happy about at all. And with this, I just wonder how much of this is being built in as sort of this like, kind of like, well, you may never know. That's the mystery of the universe, so that we can deal with aliens who may have been the ones to seed Earth. Like, I kind of feel like that's where they're going, just kind of not give any sort of resolution to it, but just have that for maybe audiences that would like that, to have that, well, we don't know.
But the thing that bugs me is back in, you know, the Roddenberry Berman era, it was, yeah, we know it, you know, and like when they were dealing with gods and the whatnot, it was always in the context of these gods that are being worshipped are in fact aliens. Mm-hmm. You know, we think about it mostly with kind of the prophets on Deep Space Nine would be kind of the most acute example of that there, you know, and I go back to an episode. Well, we'll get closer and closer to it, but I'll just throw this out there. But who watches The Watchers on, you know, TNG, where this proto-Vulcan society ends up mistaking Picard for a god because they don't know any better?
Yeah.
And, you know, so we'll get into those themes going forward in this episode here. But look, they find a Denobulan water tower on a dry, arid planet, and they're going to go investigate it, Cam. I guess that, okay. So, we find out about this kind of whistle speak, you know, Burnham is geeking out on xenoanthropology for the first time in how long? I mean, that's where she entered the series as a xenoanthropologist. And yeah. I was like, okay, that's interesting. When was the last time we ever had her like really, really dig into that as like her kind of like specialty or one of her defining characteristics?
Don't ask me to mine the depths of my mind for like details from seasons 3 and 4, but it is not a common thing. We don't get a lot of Burnham geeking out on science stuff, and I actually kind of enjoyed that. I'm like, that reminds me of Star Trek in a way that like she was being detail specific about what she was talking about, which I really appreciated. It wasn't her just saying, isn't science cool? You know, which Discovery is kind of guilty of doing at some points in the future. Like, it was actually someone explaining things in a way where she seemed genuinely excited by the idea of, you know, with the whistle speak. And I'm like, give me a little more of that.
Okay, so I agree, but okay, we have her geeking out on this whistle speak. They make a big deal of it. And we get, I think, like one whistle speak like moment on the planet. Mm-hmm. And then it's really not a factor at all in the rest of this episode, despite it being like such a pivotal part of the scene between her and Tilly.
No, that's very true.
So I'm just like, okay, like it's you and I were talking about season one of Picard earlier today, and you were talking about episode 3, how at the time it seemed exciting. But then retrospect, you know, it's when they jump on Rios's ship, La Serena, and they're off on their adventure. And then you said watching it again in retrospect, it's you realize it's really just a buildup for nothing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what this scene felt like now that, you know, we're going through it once more. It's like, oh, this scene is just kind of a buildup for nothing that would actually have any real impact on the episode moving forward.
And this was also a buildup for something else, Tyler, because this was the first mention of a few where Tilly says, we could use you at the Academy.
I also want to point out, Cam, Burnham asks Tilly, how's it going at the Academy?
Mm-hmm.
Great friend. It's only been 6 episodes since you've seen her, and this is the first time you're asking her that question. Like, Cam, are these people actually friends?
And Tilly has this just awkward reaction that it cuts away from, and I'm like, well, that's how I feel in terms of my enthusiasm for Starfleet Academy.
The TV series, yeah.
Yeah.
But Cam, like, don't you think it's absolutely bizarre that, it's taken 6 episodes for Burnham to ask Tilly, how's it going at the Academy?
Yeah, that is like a pretty significant part of what Tilly's life is at this point. It makes absolutely no sense. And you and I had talked about that in, I think it was season 4, maybe it was season 3, I don't know. But like, are these two close friends anymore? Because they barely have any screen time together. And when they do, it's basically getting together and saying, cake is eternal. And then cutting to the next scene. And yeah, this just showed that they have no idea what's going on in each other's lives, really.
Like, they're very friendly to each other, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, they are great coworkers.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so they jump onto the planet, they walk around, they hear a little whistle speak. We jump back onto the ship, and Culber and Book are wandering around, and kind of some parallels between them as well. Like, Book doesn't know what to do with himself as the search for Maul and Locke goes on without them. It's, I believe, the USS Lockhart that's searching for them at this point.
That was weird.
And, yeah.
Why would you have the Lockhart searching for Locke?
Well, you know what? I'm just going to jump down to the very end. I had notes here. They at the very end of the episode, it says the USS Lockhart has just found Maul and Locke, lock in coordinates. And I'm like, shut up. Who wrote this? Like, this is what bugs me so much. It's as if they don't have an editor to go through and just say, hey, wait, you know, this sounds a little awkward.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we should not phrase it that way, you know? And it's just like that sort of stuff. It just seems like not enough thought is put into the writing process here.
They were like, it's the last season. Just let them do whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. But we do kind of have these, you know, parallels between Book and Culber, in which they both kind of seem unsure about what to do with themselves at this particular juncture on this season of Star Trek Discovery here.
Which I did actually enjoy just having those two characters together. The material is not the greatest. I'm not that into Culber's journey at this point, but like, I like when Star Trek shows will mix up characters that we normally don't see together, spend time together. And so, like, I'm cool with Culber hanging out with Book, but hopefully this develops into something a little more interesting.
Yeah, I say mix it up. It can't hurt. I mean, beyond eating, like, food together in a shuttle, like, I don't know if it's going to move beyond, like, this episode.
Probably not. That's my guess, yeah.
So we get this, like, pilgrimage with, I think they're called Helmetians or something like that. We've got this pilgrimage going on, and there are two things that reminded me of. You never watched The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime, but there's kind of like these, they're kind of proto-hobbits, and they're going on kind of a very similar kind of nomadic lifestyle as well. So that kind of reminded me of that, but it also reminded me of how much better, I think it was like episode 4 of Andor was, depicting pilgrimage filled with a lot of hardship. And remember episode 4 was that one with the kind of that big caper,
yeah,
in which they were stealing that was it like currency off of that particular planet. I think was the episode called The Eye.
That rings a bell. Yeah.
Okay, I need to rewatch Andor again really soon. Like, I you and I were on the fence for the first couple episodes, but you and I got sucked in.
Oh, yeah.
I think giving it a rewatch, I'm going to enjoy it, like those first three episodes so much more.
I was going to say that I think those first, yeah, handful of episodes would really benefit from the rewatch.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Lady has asthma, starts coughing, magic bowls of healing. You know, and again, it's kind of these parallels that we're getting with like kind of mysticism, the unexplainable. I don't know. She's cured because of bowl sorcery, I guess.
It was the sound cure, I think is what it was. But you had to, like, yeah, circle bowls to make that sound. When I was sitting there watching that elderly lady cough up dust, I was just, it was a real moment of like, what am I doing with my life? What am I watching right now? Like, there's so many things in the world I could be watching right now, as opposed to this poor woman like coughing dust across the screen. It was like, oh, and that's when I kind of thought of that. Wasn't this the fun season? Like, how did we get here?
Well, Cam, I'll have you know, there's whimsical music that plays when it turns daylight on this planet.
Oh, that is true. Yeah. I mean, they should have made the whistle speak a little more fun. Perhaps that would have been more jovial.
Did the whimsical music annoy you? It annoyed me. I guess that's what I'm trying to announce here.
I have to be honest. It didn't really jump out to me too much.
And to me, it felt just kind of fake. Like, that, you know, they're trying too hard for it to be full of whimsy.
Right. Okay. Oh. I'd have to go back to the tape, and I don't know if that's going to happen.
Okay. So, of course, they agree to do this race in order to get inside of this temple because transporters are a bit of a problem. Although we do see that Burnham is able to figure out how to transport into it by the end.
That's accurate, yes.
So, instead, they agree to go on a run. And Cam, so you said last week Mears was probably the low point of the season, and then you and I were hoping for a bit of a bounce back.
Yeah.
Was this a bounce back, or did we dig a deeper hole in our season five viewing of Star Trek Discovery here with Whistlespeak?
This was the deepest of holes. I was like having flashbacks at certain points of this episode to the Locust Planet episode from, you know, the one with Book's family or whatever.
Yeah.
Like from season three, that kind of storytelling where I'm like, oh my God, like I have to spend 58 minutes here. And, you know, I guess I've been mixed on a lot of episodes this season, or at least a handful of episodes this season. But like this really did feel like a significant downgrade even from last week.
It just, it felt like we're back in the pattern of season four where you're just kind of stretching the story out, mm-hmm. and it just feels like a slog. And I should say, you're stretching the season-long arc out, and within that, you've got a stretched-out story within an episode. It just feels like so much of this stuff, as you say, Kim, everything from doing a captain's log at the beginning to transporting right into the water tower by the end. This seems as if it could have been like one act, and then they had to stretch it out over like five acts here.
And if you're going to have a race, you have to make it dramatic. It is not well directed. It is not exciting. There is nothing about it that's interesting. You could do this in a way where it's sort of cool. Like I think of like the opening of Wonder Woman 1984, where there's like a big race. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's not a great movie. But they managed to put together like a really exciting sequence built around kind of an unconventional race. And that's kind of what I was maybe expecting a little bit of, because this has been a little more of an action-heavy Discovery season, and yet that's not what I got at all.
No. So we jump back into sickbay. We find out that Culber has a rather handsome human brain. Good to know. But we do find out, like, he does better articulate what's going on with him, and that he's, you know, feeling more attuned to something greater than himself, mm-hmm. Greater than all of us. And so this is where we get, you know, from kind of the man of science to more becoming a man of faith, or at least they're acknowledging there's some sort of spiritual deal that happened. The thing is, I can buy this spiritual thing on Deep Space Nine and how the prophets would have that impact on, say, Kira or Sisko when they're having the visions, mm-hmm. and all that. I get that here. You know, but again, I go back to the fact that I think the progenitor storyline is an analog for, if not a god, then at least a creator story.
Yeah.
You know, with because the progenitors, you know, kind of created humanoids, you know. And meanwhile, this episode in itself, it's about connecting with the gods, as we see they do in Running, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we'll see where this goes. This storyline is kind of frustrating for me because I just don't think it's part and parcel of like what the Star Trek universe has been trying to say over the last like 55 years, though.
No. And I am like kind of surprised we're not dealing with more of the progenitors. Like, I don't know, like that seemed like an element of Star Trek mythology you'd want to mine for more material. But I feel like this season isn't doing that. It's taking that sort of element and just coming up with these stories that sort of comment on similar things like this with the people worshiping, you know, at the water tower or whatever. But like, that's not particularly, I guess it's like in terms of like Star Trek mythology, it's not the sort of thing that gets me excited to watch Star Trek.
I mean, in all fairness, Cam, you thought they were spending a lot of time with progenitors for at least the first five episodes, right?
I was hopeful.
When your theory was that Locke was a progenitor.
That's true. They completely upended that one, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we're back on the planet. There's more Renfair music playing. The planet kind of reminds me of when they went camping in CV Pocum Parabellum,
yep.
in season one. But I mean, if you're filming in Ontario, I don't know how many forests are there for you to, you know. I bet this forest is probably really close to that rock quarry that we've gone back to like 15 times on Star Trek Discovery.
Was this the same forest, do you think, from the Locust Planet from season three?
Well, it was definitely the lighting and the color correction is definitely very distinct.
Yeah.
Cam, if you're asking me to identify specific trees,
I am.
Don't know.
That's what I'm doing. Yes.
Okay. Well, the answer is I'm an idiot. I don't know. Sorry about that. Sorry to disappoint.
I need you to examine the foliage with the enthusiasm that Burnham is talking about Whistlespeak.
I would have more fun examining the foliage than I would examining this episode a third time. But, okay, Cam, you're a Starfleet captain, and you're on an alien planet, and they hand you an unknown cube.
Yeah.
I'm going to ingest this as I watch other people kind of choke it. And I'm like, okay, how about it? How many Star Trek storylines have there been about like somebody like being poisoned and somebody else having to find the cure? There's been a lot of episodes about like doctors having to find the cure for something and them being like so like happy-go-lucky about ingesting unknown cubes of whatever. I don't know.
Well, and it's like, to me, when I was watching that scene, I'm thinking of like the amount of Star Trek stories would have had a character scan that quickly.
Oh, don't they have, they had like tricorders in their eyeballs as well.
Yeah, it's the 32nd century. This isn't like, you know, the original series where they have to pull out like like a box to scan this thing. It's like they have like their eyeball things and it's like 32nd century tech. Like they could very quickly and easily scan this to determine whether it's even like, look, maybe it's not poison, but it could be poisonous to them. Like, who knows, right?
Yeah. Speaking of poison, Cam, Burnham looks at moss that's colored differently. And again, she makes this giant leap in logic in which, oh, that means that moss was exposed to radiation. Therefore, I will be able to find a control panel if I just walk up this path. And guess what, Cam? She's right. These giant leaps in logic, they just really, really bug me because it's crazy talk. But Burnham always happens to be correct.
I would be more forgiving of it if this episode was like 31 minutes, like a typical episode of Picard season 2.
Sure.
You know, you yeah. can tell they're just like, we don't have a lot of time. We got to rush through this stuff. But like, this is a 58-minute episode where there are stretches where very little of interest is actually happening. So the fact that they just will just race through the explanation as to how they discover this is like, why? Like, use your time to maybe like make that interesting as opposed to like, I don't know, Tilly sitting in a pile of dust in a cave for like 40 minutes.
One thing I'll say, you know, we get to the control panel dealio and we're going back onto the bridge. And I don't know what it was about Blue Del Barrio's performance, but there's something about it where I'm just like, I liked it. Mm-hmm. Like just kind of this earnestness. It wasn't like they were in the spotlight. It wasn't like they were trying to showcase, hey, aren't like they quirky as Adira, you know?
Well, it felt like great usage of a supporting character where like, you know, when you go to like some of the older shows like, you know, Uhura or Sulu, like they have techno babble that's the reason they're on the show, you know, that week or featured. But like they bring personality and character to it. And that's what I thought they did very well with Adira, where ultimately what Adira is delivering is not the most, you know, character driven of material, but like it was all driven by their reactions to feeling like the pressure of the situation. And that was interesting. My one other note on it though was, as much as I liked what Adira was doing, I thought Rayner is just becoming lame. I'm like, this character who had like, you know, vinegar and like some real bite in his first couple episodes, I'm watching him now play cheerleader going, oh boy, like this is the character I'm now signed up for the next couple of episodes, because clearly Saru ain't coming back anytime soon.
Well, they've clearly softened his edges, and I think they did that on purpose, starting with the time bug episode. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, so like everything I found interesting about this character, it's now gone.
Yeah. There was a line where he says to Adira something like, you haven't been the same since the time bug was on the ship. And I'm like, what a weird line to have to say.
I remember in season 2 of Discovery, some of the dialogue about the time crystals was some of the most awkward dialogue there.
Yeah, now. That's true.
But okay. So the other line of dialogue that really annoyed me was when Burnham decides to go investigate the moss, and we have another runner coming up behind her and Tilly, and she has to shout at the runner, "I'm out," as if, you know, like he needs to know that she's no longer running in the race. I'm just like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's fine. Go drink your bowl of water. He'll understand it.
Have you ever thought of Tilly as the queen of endurance? Is that an element of that character that jumps out to you?
Yes. In season 2, I think it was, what was it, Saints of Imperfection, in which they established she was a track star. And remember, like, she ran that race around Discovery, and then she had the hallucination from May, the fungal sort of parasite host, yeah. And then she beat everybody in the race despite having a 5-minute conversation.
That is true. Like, I definitely thought of that in regards to the character, but is that what the writers were thinking?
So, Kim, the only way I can like figure out headcanon this is that she is an she's a human, mm-hmm. and these aliens have terrible, terrible, like, respiratory systems.
Yeah, yeah. Because, like, when a character says, like, I'm the queen of endurance, I'm like, well, I don't know that there's a lot in the show where I can really draw that. Like, that doesn't speak to the character I necessarily know. Tilly has many qualities that are very positive, but I never really thought of this character as, like endurance is what defines them.
Yeah. All right. So, what was the, was it Maven or Maeve or whatever that kid's name is who's also running the race? It's down to the two of them. She's out, and for whatever reason, Tilly has to lift her up. Tilly has to risk her own mission, her own success and her own mission, to lift up this kid's spirits to help her finish the race.
That is correct, yes.
I was like, oh, yeah, great. You're putting the mission at risk there.
Yeah.
So you can make somebody feel good.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, who cares? Like, well, I know Discovery cares. Like, because the message of Discovery is we have to be emotionally vulnerable at all times.
Yes. Can you imagine Picard doing this?
You know, I was thinking about this. Okay, Cam, I wanted to ask you this. With the whole running story, mm-hmm. who would have been the best kind of like, or the most analogous pair of captains and supporting characters in another series? Would this have been a Kirk and McCoy showcase? Would this have been a Picard and Geordi episode? Ben and O'Brien? Like, I don't know. Like what would be kind of the best? Maybe it would have been like Archer and Hoshi go for a run together.
I was thinking Archer, and then whether it's Hoshi or Trip or maybe T'Pol. But I think that's like, can you picture many of the captains running outside of Archer?
I'm trying to think. I can picture Kirk running or, you know, doing a jog.
Janeway, maybe.
I can picture back on Ito, you know, I mean, Picard wasn't running, but I could picture definitely the rest of the crew running. So, but I don't know. This whole thing, I mean, if listeners haven't figured it out, this is a pretty silly storyline.
It gave me a lot of shades of Battery Boy, ultimately, which an episode I came back around on, but I kept thinking of that episode when I was watching this.
And I guess, yeah, jumping forward then, you know, they win the contest, and their reward is they get to be sacrificed to the gods, which is kind of the Strange New Worlds Battery Boy episodes that you're alluding to there. So, okay. So they spend a long, long time establishing that, yeah, we're stuck in here.
That's right. They spend a crazy amount of time with them just like wandering around inside these this tower, looking at numbers on the walls, and I'm like sitting there just on my like writing notes, like, where is this going? Like, what are we doing? Why is this taking so long?
Well, it's taking so long. Like, we don't need to spend this much time here. You know, I'm just kind of like. And again, this episode's like 56 minutes long. It could have easily been 40 minutes, though. And that's why we're getting to like the, you know, you go back to like the Berman era, where those episodes are like 42, 46 minutes long, mm-hmm. and they're tighter. You know, and they just like, they're so much better pacing than this. For an episode all about racing, not a great pace.
It also didn't do a very good job of building up kind of the peril. And yes, like they are running out of oxygen, but like, you never really felt the actual tension of what Tilly, and I think the character's name was Rava. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Rava, okay.
But I don't know. I just wrote, I have a note that says Rava's buyer's remorse. so whatever. But yeah, like you never really felt like that kind of like the horror or the peril of what they're experiencing. And that would have given the episode a little more of a punch. It felt very flat.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, is this how Tilly's going to die? Is this the end of Tilly's storyline in the final season of Discovery? Like, you know the answer is they'll save them somehow.
What about the Starfleet Academy spinoff?
yeah. Well, no, that's why they're alluding to getting Burnham over to the Academy.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so Burnham beams into the tower in front of Rava's father. Yep. She goes all the way, spills all the beans. Talks about aliens to this primitive species. I was asking for a while if she's going to go Men in Black on him, you know, with like some sort of red memory wiping stick or something like that.
Or Superman 2. The kiss.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot about it. Yeah. So, okay. They're talking about how, like, the technology, not the gods, are bringing the rain here.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking a little bit what they're hinting at thematically about Culber's journey, about spirituality and uncertainty here. So that's when it was at this point where I was like, okay, maybe they are hinting that, like, technology is responsible. It's like there, or whatever you might think is kind of a supernatural thing could be explained by you just not having the understanding of how maybe technology operates, you know? And I was like, okay, maybe that's a point that they're making. But then we've got this line later on where Burnham says, like, nothing we've shown you, she's talking to Rava's father, nothing we've shown you doesn't mean gods don't exist. And I'm like, is that true? Like, is she saying that because Burnham believes that herself, or is she saying that just to make him feel better? Like, that's what I could not figure out.
Doesn't she have a line that says, like, maybe I was sent by a god to him? Something along those lines?
Well, by that, she was talking about Kovic.
Well, of course. David Cronenberg, the Canadian god, of course.
Yeah. So, I don't know. For me, it's just like, this could have been like a TNG episode, but they would have found like a better way to like manifest this episode, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's also just like something very simplistic about the fact that, like, she breaks the prime directive, whatever, Burnham knows best, but explains the situation to this guy and is like, you know, you need to stop doing these sacrifices. And he's like, okay, like, people will fight against me on that. She's like, yeah, but, you know, beliefs can evolve. And it's like, okay, cool. I'll work at this. And I'm like, this character was pretty committed to the cause. And I'm like, She managed to, like, change his mind in, like, three lines of dialogue. Whereas, like, I think if this were an episode of TNG, you would have had probably a 15-minute stretch of Picard going back and forth, and there would have been ongoing dialogue. Like, and they would probably reach a very uneasy point where it's like, we may have been okay today, but we don't know how the society will continue to evolve. Whereas here it was like one little speech with Burnham, and he's like, you know what? I'm willing to make the change if you are.
Well, it's just interesting, like, our critique of the show is, like, they are stretching out the unimportant things, but just, like, whizzing right by the more important things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think, like, There's something compelling about that. And when we talked about that Lift Us Up, Where Suffering Cannot Reach, yeah, the Battery Boy episode, like, Pike doesn't really have that moment to really talk to this society about changing. That's not kind of where the episode ends. Whereas they could have gone on a pivot and actually had more of an exploration of this. Like, what is it going to mean to the society? Give us some sort of insight. Have a character who has the opposing point of view and have more of a debate, but it skips over all of that and everything's, I guess, going to change as long as, you know, the father character sticks to his guns.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just so boring, Cam. And just go back to an episode like Who Watches the Watchers that already did this story, and they did it so much better.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was definitely picking up pieces from other superior episodes, because even like Who Watches the Watchers, but I also thought of the episode First Contact as well, when she's like showing the planet from space to him and explaining that. That's also in Watchers, but it's that kind of classic TNG story where it's like, we are showing an alien species kind of the wonders of the universe. But again, they just glossed over it in like one line of dialogue where I'm like, honestly, I would have been much happier if you just delved in more into this sort of stuff.
Okay, so Rava and her papa, they are reunited. Everything's solved. Blah, blah, blah. They figure out some sort of number sequencing. You know, Book and Culber are eating food in the shuttle. You know, Book's talking about his love of Burnham, you know. I guess it is kind of interesting that they are talking about, like, you can still kind of compartmentalize certain aspects about, like, relationships and what one thing might mean in one relationship and how that differs in other relationships. So I thought that was actually one of the few, like, kind of insightful, interesting things that Discovery had to say in this episode. You know, I like this scene overall.
It's almost like when they have a moment like that, you're like, why wasn't the episode really about that?
Yeah.
Because that's like more profound than anything they're really doing on the, you know, water tower planet.
Well, it's also something we can relate to much more as viewers.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so we've got another puzzle piece, you know, clicked in. Great.
One to go.
Yeah, Cam. And then we find out that the USS Lockhart just found Maul and Locke. Let's lock coordinates. Okay.
Well, it's good to know that, you know, if they are captured by the Lockhart, that'll happen off screen, which is what you want.
All right, Cam. Spore drive, engage. We've got, Cam, this episode is, we're 60% of the way. We're almost two-thirds of the way through the season. We only have 4 more hours left of the Discovery crew.
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel weird to you? Sure haven't seen Saru in a while either.
No. Has it been 2 or 3 episodes?
When was the last time? We saw him when the last time we saw him was when the jerk Vulcan aide was trying to get him to break off the engagements. Was that episode 4? No, I think that was episode 3.
Was that 3? Yeah, because it was like such a small kind of uninteresting subplot in probably a better episode. So it doesn't really linger in the mind that much. But yeah, boy, Saru, this will not go down as the great Saru season in his final season.
No. You mentioned last week, I think, about like saving money on Doug Jones, and I think I pushed back and said, like, well, it's already part of the contract. I wonder if they renegotiated his contract and he's like, you know what, I'll just be in like 5 episodes this season.
Yeah.
And that's saving the money as well.
I just can't see them paying him week after week after week without showing him doing anything.
Yeah. Because I'm sure the deal is like with like Tig Notaro. It's like they say, okay, yeah, you'll appear in like 4 episodes a season, and in those episodes, we'll put your name in the credits.
Yeah, and I wonder, because they were mentioning this before the season came out, like long ago, they were talking about how Saru would have a smaller role this season, and I just wonder if it was like, maybe he was busy with something else, so they negotiated a different deal, because it seemed like they were making it very clear, very early on, that Saru would have more of a Tilly-like role this season.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. I mean, I'm sure we'll get a lot of him in the finale, but...
oh, yeah.
All right, Cam. This episode, was it the worst so far this season?
Yes. Hands down, no competition in my mind.
I'm almost wishing I watched episode 7, you know, just to have something to go on. I don't know. We'll... 4 more episodes left of us recapping this, but I you know what, Cam? I think Discovery has nowhere to go but up after Whistlespeak.
Yeah, this is like the types of episodes that were just intolerable in previous seasons. And I'm just looking at the IMDb ratings. They weren't big fans.
Shocker.
It's actually tied with Jinal with a 5.7. I would say Jinal was better, though.
I think Jinal was notably better.
Yeah.
Like by a significant margin.
Although Whistlespeak did just drop, so give it a couple days, it may drop a little lower.
Okay.
But yeah, this was not a... This is not the victorious home stretch you would imagine that they want.
I think... I don't know, man. Like, don't the producers seem so self-satisfied about everything they do?
They do seem very high on their own supply, yes.
Yeah. So maybe to them, this is like the peak.
Doesn't this make you all the more interested for Las Vegas convention this summer? To hear them just like talk about this season?
Yeah, it makes me interested in organizing a jog session where we're dressed up as those aliens. And we have really dry lips.
We have like salt cubes we're feeding to each other.
Yes. So Cam, every summer, you, me, and your sister, we do this kind of summer movie wager in which we kind of rank what movies will make the most, you know, from 1 through 10. I think we've shared it in years past. I don't know if we did it last summer, but I don't know. This is really just for fun, for bragging rights. It's silly. I kicked ass last summer, most dominating win of all the years that we've ever done it. You and Janine did not recognize my genius, did not give me the accolades that I felt I deserved, but that's okay. I'm not bitter at all.
And never mind the years that I won.
Yeah, but the thing is, those years that you won, it was not the dominant success that I had, though.
Okay, well, we bet big on Little Mermaid, and we paid for it.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, the thing is, like, there's like a point system. So if you think a movie is going to be the number 5 grossing movie of the summer, and it actually lands on number 5, then you get like extra points, like for ranking it like on the dot. And I think last year, didn't I rank like 4 or 5 of the movies like right on the dot?
There was a few, yeah. And anyone who's interested in the details can go to summermoviewager.com. there's a website built to explaining all the rules and the point systems for maybe in future years you'd like to play along.
Yeah. So I think like you get like the most points for guessing the number one movie as well as the number 10 movie, because I think the number 10 movie is always a challenge to guess correctly.
Yeah, number 10, I have fluked it a couple times, but it was a fluke. It was not based on any sort of perception that I had going in.
I got it last year, and I think, was it Oppenheimer?
No, that was like number 4, I think.
Okay. Well, whatever it was, I got it last year. I was just so dominant, I forget how much my dominance pervaded that. So, Cameron, why don't you go first?
Okay, so number 1, I have Deadpool and Wolverine. I just feel like this one... it's going to be the biggest draw of the summer. I know it's rated R, but I'm betting big on it. Number 2, Despicable Me 4, because people love Minions for some reason. Number 3, Inside Out 2. Number 4, Twisters. Number 5, Bad Boys Ride or Die. Number 6, Quiet Place, Day 1. Number 7, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Number 8, Furiosa. Number 9, The Fall Guy. And number 10, Horizon, An American Saga, Part 1.
Yeah, so Cam, you also have two dark horses as well.
I do, Garfield and If, the new John Krasinski film.
I think you would agree with me that this summer is shaping up to be something like just seems unpredictable, like really hard to like wrap our heads around, more so than previous summers, right?
Wildly so. And it's like box office in general has been so down that like some of these movies could come out and make nothing and still wind up in the top 10. It's going to be a weird one. And like... you know, you were bugging me online about having Twisters so high, but I'm just like, it seems like a big event type movie, like a big spectacle that might draw people, because I can't depend on franchises or anything else nowadays.
Yeah. My list is a little wild because I think the summer's going to be a little wild. I think we're going to have to take some swings. What I noticed about your list, this is just how I can tap into like your strategy here is I noticed that your list was more or less kind of in the order of how the preceding films, because most of this is like franchise stuff, right?
Yeah, this summer, more or less, yeah.
Yeah, and I noticed that your list was kind of mostly in the order of how well the preceding franchises performed financially. And so if Deadpool made, you know, $800 million, you know, for Deadpool 2, mm-hmm. then you would not put a movie that made $700 million, like a previous like movie within that franchise over top of Deadpool. That's more or less my observation from your list.
That was kind of the case. Something like Twisters, I don't even acknowledge the first one because I think the majority of the people going to that movie don't even really know what Twister is.
Yeah.
And then like Quiet Place, I put a little further down just because I'm just like, it doesn't have the original stars. Maybe that lowers it. But yeah, that's somewhat right.
Yeah. So for me, I went a little wild. I agree. Deadpool and Despicable Me 4, I think those are going to be the top two movies, 1 and 2, respectively. After that, this is where I get wild. I put Bad Boys at number 3,
yeah.
Furiosa at number 4, Apes at number 5. The one I feel least confident about is Inside Out at number 2, because the last Inside Out movie made a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
Way more than a decade ago, and we see that the Disney Plus effect really hammered Lightyear.
Yeah,
and that one really underperformed. So even though Inside Out made just a ton of money, I just don't know how much buzz there is for the sequel. But kids, parents, who knows there? At number 7, Quiet Place. Number 8, Garfield. Number 9, I also had The Fall Guy there. And number 10, Twisters. Dark Horse, I put If there. If looks terrible. Like, I watched the trailer. It just looks absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
But who knows? Maybe it turns out to be good. I don't know. Or at least not good. But kids want to go see it with their parents. And the other Dark Horse is the Kevin Costner Horizon, which you had at your number 10.
Yeah, that one I was like kind of wondering if you get like a Sound of Freedom like bump where it would wind up in the top 10. Just plays to a different audience.
Yeah. We shall see. So I don't know. I think either way, you and I will be able to ridicule one or the other mm-hmm. based on our picks because we have like, you know, fairly disparate picks for the most part there. I think we have just Deadpool, Despicable, and Fall Guy are the only ones that line up on our lists.
How many of these movies are you excited for?
I'm really excited for Furiosa.
Yep.
And then to a lesser degree, Apes, Deadpool, and then to a lesser degree, Quiet Place. And then maybe, you know, I put Quiet Place on par with Twisters. Glenn Powell, he's having a moment here, and but I don't know if the director of this is the one who directed, oh, what was that really lovely movie a couple years ago, Cam, about the South Korean family that moved to like Arkansas or Alabama?
Minari?
Minari, yeah. I think it's the Minari director doing Twisters.
It is, yeah.
Which is a bit of a jump in genres, but that's not uncommon in Hollywood. So I'm just wondering how well the action is. And I do recall, like, I think you told me that you only saw that first Twister movie like once.
Yeah.
My sister and I, we watched that movie like a lot, like way back in 96.
Yeah, I just watched it once when it first hit home video, and then I've never seen it since. I'll probably rewatch it before I see Twisters, even though I suspect it'll be very minimal crossover.
I don't think you need any background at all.
Probably not, no. And like, I will say, like, Furiosa and Planet of the Apes are my top two favorites that I'm looking forward to this summer, the ones I'm really excited about. I am very curious about Horizon, just because Kevin Costner is taking a weird swing, and I'm like, you know what? I'm down for directors taking wild swings, because we don't get a lot of that these days.
I really liked Open Range.
Yeah, me too. It was really good. And I like Dances with Wolves. I've liked a few Kevin Costner directed films. So, you know.
You're big into the NFL draft one too, right?
Draft Day?
Draft Day.
I never saw that, but I did see The Postman. And it was a swing.
Oof. Oof. That was... So I actually read the book before the movie came out, like back when I was in high school.
There was a book?
It was based on a book, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And the book was pretty good. It was pretty interesting. And that movie sucked.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, oh, this is garbage.
And you and I went and saw the Waterworld stunt show spectacular when we were at Universal Studios. So that was some Kevin Costner content right there.
Yeah, he was actually doing his own stunts in this stunt show. It's pretty amazing.
Does that show three times a day.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that man is the king of endurance.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you, Tilly.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll be back next week with a review of the 7th episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 5. Ariga? Is that it?
Sure.
Sure. Why not?
You know, if I sat and watched all of episode 7 like I had the chance to do last Wednesday, then I would have known for sure.
Right. Okay. And you can, of course, also find us on Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in vacuum chamber, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORT. T as in twistas forever. ON.
Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Okay, so we're back on the planet. There's more Ren Faire music playing.